evening, everybody. Welcome back to, where are we? Exploring the Lord of the Rings. That's where we are. It's session number 294 tonight as we roll into March of 2024. And tonight, tempers get a little bit short at the doors of Moria. We got right up to what looks like Boromir's, what may be, and I wouldn't even have you know, expected this a little while back. But what I think is the first genuinely undiplomatic thing that Boromir has said. There's, you know, I still acknowledge that there is potentially a certain amount of wryness or even exasperation in his lead on at the end of the last speech that he made, though I still don't think that he's being like that he's like rolling his eyes while he says that. But in any case, tonight we're going to go back to the passage where it looks like Boromir more or less completely loses it. But quick announcement, our next spring moot, so we're going to be entering soon into the sort of intense regional moot season of the spring. Our next regional moot, though, is not going to be in this month. It's next month. About a month from now, I will be in Houston, Texas for Tex Moot again. We're coming back to Houston, and I'm looking forward to seeing folks again. Tex Moot is always such a wonderful time. Tex Moot, one of our longest running moots. We've been wandering about the great state of Texas. We have met in Fort Worth and Waco and Austin and Houston and San Antonio, and now we're wandering back to Houston this coming year. So this coming year, next month, as is this very year. So looking forward to that. That's going to be the first weekend. There's the 6th. Yeah, I almost forgot the number. April 6th. And then 2 weeks after that, three weeks after that, on April 27th, I'll be in the UK for our first European moot in, golly, 5 years. It's been since 2019. It was pre-pandemic the last time we did a moot in Europe. Really excited to be back over in Europe. So we're going to be back in the UK for UK moot in York, England, on the 27th of April. So those are the two moots that are coming up next. They're coming up next month in April. And of course, as always, you can join us remotely for those moots because all of our moots are as fully hybrid as we can possibly make them. There's a bunch of other moots coming. I won't give all the details about them because there's only so many at a time, but we do have another moot in Canada. We have the Edmonton moot coming up out in Edmonton, Alberta, Wild Rose moot. And then we are also going to be, we're going to be in California too. SoCal moot, also coming up in rapid succession there at the beginning and the middle of May. So we're going to have four moots in the next 2 months after this. So that'll be the the really fun travel period there, which I'm looking forward to. So anyway, that's where we're going to be. Oh, Fourth Dauntless, I don't worry about jet lag. I just enjoy being on the plane. Being on the plane is my favorite thing. I love being on planes. So that's what's coming up. Let's get back into the text here. All right. We started this one last time. We talked especially about Aragorn, who knew Gandalf well, remained silent and unmoved. And of course, we were noting the implication there that if only Aragorn is silent and unmoved, then everyone else is unsilent and moved during this time. And so the words that we get from Boromir are certainly not alone. So that is one thing to keep in mind. I think that one impression that it seems that many people have, just based on things I've heard people say about Boromir, one of the impression that many people have is that Boromir is the kind of disgruntled party member, that he's the that he's out of step with everybody else, right? And I think certainly in this moment, that is not the case, right? Boromir's words are the ones that are quoted, right? And you can see why Boromir singled out. Gandalf singles him out, right? Because what Boromir says is presumably kind of the biggest deal of anything that anybody says. But everybody is talking, right? And I think I can't help but remember the fact that the last time we got comments from Boromir, he was sort of gently calling for a vote. Remember that? Not unless the vote of the whole party is against me, which was the first time we had any hint that a vote was happening, right? The Boromir's kind of appeal to democracy there, as if he were flirting with the idea, you know, he was saying he would go along with, you know, with the rest of the party if they did all vote against him. But that he was kind of inviting other people to support his point of view and perhaps go with him. It does seem to me, in the context of that, it does seem to me significant that he is, in speaking up here, even in speaking up as impatiently as he is, in a sense, representing the majority here. I think it's another reason both that his words have been selected to be the ones included in that, right? Again, if all of the other, seven of them are all speaking at once here, you know, we only get Boromir's words. Why don't we get the other six? Why did Tolkien choose Boromir to be the representative spokesperson for the unsilent and moved people in the party? So anyway, I think that one implication here is that there is a sense is not that he alone is the disgruntled one, not that he is out of step with the rest of the party, but rather that he is, JJ, exactly as you say, that he's voicing the dissenting opinion, and that many people are expressing themselves in ways which are in line with what Boromir is saying. Yes, that he's closer to the mouthpiece of the party here, April, than he is to, like, you know, the solitary, you know, deviating opinion. Anyway, okay. So let's go back and look at what he says here. "Then what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot?" cried Boromir, glancing back with a shudder at the dark water. "You told us that you had once passed through the mines. How could that be if you did not know how to enter?" Okay, so he does, as Gandalf points out, ask two questions, right? Now, the second one is sort of more rhetorical here, right? You know what it reminds me of? Gandalf saying the answer to your first question here, it kind of reminds me of when Gandalf at the beginning of The Hobbit says to Bilbo, "I shall grant you what you have asked." And Bilbo's like, "I beg your pardon? I haven't asked for anything." And he says, "Yes, you have, three times now. My pardon, right? I give it you." You know, Bilbo has, you know, even in responding to it, he says, "I beg your pardon," again, right? And he's already said it twice. And of course, he is not conscious of having asked for anything, because he's just using that as a figure of speech, right? But Gandalf has this sort of way of pouncing on, you know, words and expressions and things like that, right? So he takes the two questions. And again, I think clearly both of them, honestly, are rhetorical questions, right? you know, what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot? Isn't expect an answer to that question, right? How could that be if you did not know how to enter? Maybe he's, but I don't think he's like insisting on an answer to that question. He's just expressing. It is a question designed to express his feelings at the moment, rather than a question seeking information, right? And Gandalf is going to choose to respond as if both of his questions are two separate, independent queries seeking information, right? But Boromir's questions themselves, what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot? Cried Boromir. Now, here's the thing that I find most interesting in that first question. We know that he was the most vocal of all of the opponents of coming to Moria in the first place, right? He did not want to go through Moria. He would not enter Moria unless the vote of the whole party was against him, right? He thought it was a horrible and disastrous idea. And at first, it sounds like that's what he's alluding to. But his actions make it clear that his first question does not simply mean, why did you bring us to Moria? When he says this accursed spot, he means the shore of this horrible lake. Right? As we see Boromir glancing back with a shudder at the dark water. Right, Boromir is clearly creeped out by this place that they're in. Right, it's not Moria that he's objecting to here. It's the lake and the shore and the cliff. It's this, literally this spot, not this region, not this route, right? It's that particular spot next to the lake. We're not told why. Like, why it is that Boromir is creeped out by the lake. I mean, is it more than other people? But it seems the glancing back with a shudder over his shoulder, like, if we didn't get that in that little cue, right? If we just got cried Boromir and then moving on to the next part, it would sound like he was following up his Moria objections. It would sound a more general kind of piece of frustration, right? Venting of his own frustration. And again, I don't doubt that it is, you know, that that's definitely there as well. But Boromir does seem to be sensitive to this particular place. If we remember ahead just a little bit, this was one of my favorite trivia questions. This was a trivia question. It was at Sunshine Moot. Adam made a trivia game that we played. And one of the trivia questions in our Sunshine Moot game was, who's the one who throws rocks into the pool? Who throws a rock into the pool in front of the doors of Moria? And of course, the answer is not Merry and Pippin. The answer is Boromir. Boromir is going to be the one who's going to throw a rock into the lake. So there is something. Like, this lake gets to him. This lake gets to him. It gets to him in a couple ways. That is to say, we have a couple places where we can see that this place is getting to him, right? Now, obviously, this is just compounding the fact that he really didn't want to come here in the first place, and also that he knows they're being chased by wolves. So he knows they're being chased by wolves. And remember, he was the one who was anticipating getting trapped between the wolves and the wall, right? And secondly, he didn't even want to go to Moria at all. And now thirdly, when they get there, he now finds this new thing, right, that he didn't even anticipate. You told us that you had once passed through the mines. How could that be if you did not know how to enter? And so the question is, one of my so that Boromir has lost his grip on his diplomacy for the first, I think is clear, right? Boromir is, that question, how could that be if you did not know how to enter? Gandalf is going to call him out on what is the plain implication of that. He has not accused Gandalf of lying. But he's putting it out there, right? Gandalf is not overreacting to think that Boromir is calling his integrity into question. So why? What's going on? We've seen Boromir before. Again, we've seen his resistance before. We've seen plenty of evidence that Boromir feels that this company is not exactly being led by, the A-team here, right? That quite likely he could do a better job of leading this expedition than Gandalf and Aragorn have been doing. But he has been very tactful so far in not doing anything about that, right? In not speaking against them and not undermining them. We've seen that kind of thing again and again. So why, my question is, what are we seeing from Boromir here? Because what I don't hear here, I don't hear some kind of like decision on Boromir's part to say, okay, that's it. I've had it, right? I am now going to start an open campaign against Gandalf. I'm now going to attempt to undermine Gandalf's authority actively, right? This cannot be borne, right? I don't see that. Maureen, I agree. The shudder indicates he's afraid of the water. I think we are seeing Boromir afraid in ways we've never seen Boromir afraid before. This is Boromir not on his game, right? What is it that's getting off his game? It's not frustration. I think it's fear. I also think when he asks his question, the second question, the rude one, how could that be if you did not know how to enter? I think there's also some confusion, some bewilderment here, right? Boromir knows. Remember, and this has come up before, lying and accusing someone of lying is a huge deal in Middle-earth, right? And, I mean, it's a huge deal in many older European cultures. A lot of time modern readers will kind of pass over or imply, we'll sort of suggest readings of the text which hinge upon the idea that the character is lying, right? And they will do so on the premise of like, well, like people lie all the time if they have motivation to lie, right? That is not at all common. It's not to say that no one ever lies in The Lord of the Rings. It's just to say it's a big deal. And it's kind of even a bigger deal to accuse someone of lying. So I think that kind of factors into that second question in two different ways. One is, again, I think Boromir is genuinely bewildered. It would be super weird for Gandalf to have told them all, like he just to look them in the face and say, I've been through Moria and I wouldn't take you there if I didn't know the way. I mean, he pushed all of his cards in the middle of the table there, right? I've been there. I wouldn't even suggest it if there were no way to get through. I've been through myself and I can get through again. So follow me there. Right. I mean, Gandalf put his like whole, you know, integrity on the line. Right. He put his entire reputation on the line with that. It would be super weird for him just to make that up. Right. I mean, it's not just that Boromir would be scandalized to discover that Gandalf had been lying. It's something that Boromir, like, I think he wouldn't even think of that. Like, I wonder to what extent, when he's asking that question, I think it's possible that Boromir is not even thinking that he is accusing Gandalf of lying. I think that when he asks that question, I think that he means exactly what he says. How could that be? Like, what you've said, and, you know, I have every reason to believe that you are a man of honor, so I believe you when you say that you've been through, but how can it be that you've been through if you don't know how to do, like, it doesn't compute that you said you've been through and now you can't get in? Like, how does that work? Right? How does that work? So I think, and when you add to the fact that he's afraid, not just like anxious, not just maybe wolves will trap us between them and the wall, right? Maybe we're going to be cornered and die like rats here against the cliff. That's stress already, right? But with this extra, whatever he's feeling from the lake, right? The deep creepiness of the situation, of the locale as well, right? Boromir, now triggered by this fear, I think rather than being aggressive against Gandalf, what I'm hearing in this question is a kind of entirely undiplomatic transparency on Boromir's part. I think that in that last question, he is merely giving voice to exactly what he's thinking without stopping to think about the implications of it, without thinking about what it implies about Gandalf, which it does imply that he must be lying, right? Yes, April, tact has escaped him. Exactly. Yes. And Miss Ray, that's exactly it. I do think that his nerves are frayed. Yes, Maureen, exactly. No filters. I think his fear and the pressure of the moment, but most importantly, his fear of the lake, his fear of that, whatever it is. And he doesn't know what it is that he's afraid of, which I'm sure doesn't help the situation. This is not Boromir leading a rebellion. This is Boromir just, again, Maureen, exactly as you said, this is Boromir without filters, right? How could that be if you did not know how to enter? Gandalf's response. The answer to your first question is that I do not know the word yet. Now, what was Boromir's first question? Boromir's first question is, what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot? Oh, wait. No, he's answering the first question. Do not you know the word, Gandalf? Interesting. So it's three questions that he's asked. Sorry, I forgot about that one. Do not you know the word, Gandalf? And we talked about the difference between do not you and do you not. Do not you know the word, Gandalf? The answer to your first question is that I do not know the word yet. But we shall soon see. And, he added, with a glint in his eyes under their bristling brows, you may ask what is the use of my deeds when they are proved useless. As for your other question, so he first addresses the first question, I don't know the word yet. The answer to the second question. He doesn't give an answer to the second question. Second question, what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot? You may ask what is the use of my deeds when they are proved useless. Notice how he's building off of what he says is the answer to the first question. It's all about the yet, right? What he and yes, Nathan, you're right. He doesn't deny that the spot is accursed. Yeah, yeah. His only answer to both of those first two, both of his first questions, do not you know the word? And what was the use of bringing us to the accursed spot? Is give it time. I don't know the word yet, but I'll probably figure it out, right? And what was the use of bringing us here? We'll see. You may ask what is the use of them when they are proved useless. In the meantime, stay tuned to see for yourself what the use of them is, right? Yeah, well, but I think you could say it that way, that Gandalf is asserting that Boromir has not proved his deeds were useless. Yes, but I think Boromir is not presenting proof exactly, right? I don't think it's exactly a proving situation. But I think that it's... what Gandalf is saying is that the event... Boromir is essentially asserting, I think, that Gandalf not knowing the word to get in, Gandalf not knowing how to open the doors, has proved that coming here was useless. Like, for Boromir's acting as if, like, that's the proof, right? That's all he needed to know, right? Is that that it was obviously useless to come here if you didn't know how to get in, right? And again, the only response to that is, wait, you're jumping the gun, right? Is he responding, Gandalf, responding to a latent challenge? Yes. Yes, in a sense. But, okay. On the one hand, sure. Yeah. Gandalf, or Boromir's second speech there, right? His speech in response to Gandalf saying no, is, on the one hand, totally a challenge, right? I mean, through his first rhetorical question there, what is the use of bringing us to this cursed spot? He is basically saying, what you did was useless, worse than useless, right? Like, you've done this useless thing, bringing us all the way to this place, which is a very dangerous place for lots of reasons, right? And it was at best irresponsible to do that, right? When you didn't even know whether you could get in or whether you could open the door or not. And then, you know, by reviewing the fact that actually, like, not only did you do this rash thing, which is bring us to this spot that you don't know for sure you can get into, but in addition, you gave us your assurance that we could get through, that you could do this. And yet all that time, you didn't know how to get in? What the heck? Right? So... Yes, I acknowledge that both of those questions are challenges to Gandalf's authority. At the same time, though, again, what I don't see here is Boromir leading a coup, right? Or, you know, denouncing Gandalf or something like that. Yeah, I agree, Jackie. They're not unreasonable at all. Especially the way that Gandalf ends. If Gandalf had simply said, when Boromir says, do not you know the word, Gandalf? If Gandalf had responded to that by saying, not yet, but we shall soon see. Okay, right? But it isn't. He just says, no. And then there's enough of a pause for everybody to look dismayed and to be unsilent and moved, right? And then Boromir says his thing, right? It is, yes, Erd, you're right. That's a bit of a theatrical move by Gandalf. Simply saying no! Exclamation point to Boromir's question. Without attempts at reassurance or anything else. Yeah, Kurtzimus, I agree. Gandalf is kind of asking for what he's getting here. I don't think Gandalf has a whole lot of justification for being upset about, you know, being sort of challenged here, right? Yeah. Now, it is a good question, Johnny, about how angry is Gandalf in this scene? Is Gandalf upset? I don't... I don't think... Okay. The place where I think he is plainly and explicitly upset is in the second part. When the glint in his eyes under their bristling brows, when his brows start bristling and his eyes start glinting, Gandalf's angry. Right? Boromir's second speech has kind of upset Gandalf. You may ask what is the use of my deeds when they are proved useless. As for your other question, do you doubt my tale? He calls it out into the open. Are you in fact calling me a liar right now? Or have you no wits left? He says with counter insult. Are you calling me a liar or are you just an idiot? I did not enter this way. I came from the east. So, is he upset? Yes. I do think we can see Gandalf being a little bit defensive here. I do think I agree, though, with people who were saying that I don't think he's upset from the beginning here. Nor do I think he's, like, furious at the end. Do I think he's annoyed? Yes. A bit miffed? Karina? Yes, I agree. I agree. A bit miffed, perhaps. But I don't think he's angry, and I don't think that the first... again, he did set it up, right? By just saying no to Boromir's question. I think the first part of his response, the answer to your first question, Boromir, is that I do not know the word yet, but we shall soon see. He is, in fact, on the one hand, he does seem to want, I mean, in saying that, he is giving a certain amount of reassurance, right, to the party as a whole, that he believes he's going to be able to come up with it, right? We shall soon see. But again, at the same time, he's I agree that he was being a little bit dramatic here. Yeah. And P. McSwain from YouTube, I agree with you. P. McSwain says, Boromir is a proven effective general in war. I don't see him freaking out because something adverse happens. I see him calmly adjusting to the situation. So I think that Boromir must be really rattled to lose it. I agree. And that's why I think that glancing back with a shudder at the dark water is so significant and so revealing. Even the kind of wry acceptance, even if it has a touch of the sardonic in it, of the lead on at the end of his previous speech, right? Even that has, there's a certain kind of unflappability to that, right? This is different, right? Boromir is rattled. I think that's exactly right. I think Gandalf, so do I think that Gandalf wants to reassure the other members of the company that he can figure it out? Yes. Do I think that's his first priority? No. No, I don't. Because he didn't do it right away, right? He could have done. Remember, we've seen Gandalf be conciliatory and even almost on the verge of smarmy, trying to put a happy face on things and reassure everybody. Remember the things that led Sam to make, sort of morose comments on his own, quietly to the side to Frodo, on the trip down into Holland. So we have seen Gandalf acting, going out of his way in order to keep people's spirits up and to encourage them. This ain't it. Yeah, he's been a cheerleader the whole time. Absolutely, Jackie, that's exactly right. This is not Gandalf being a cheerleader. He could have done. He's not. I think that... So why is it? How do we explain what does it show us about Gandalf's frame of mind here? That he both does, just to get simply saying no to the question, an answer which dismays everybody, right? Everybody except Aragorn. I mean, that is the opposite of a reassuring answer, right? Now, he rebounds a little bit. I do not know the word yet, but we shall soon see, right? But he doesn't go there originally. Why not? Why wouldn't he, right? I think it suggests that he is... somebody just a little bit ago said that he was concentrating. I think he's focused, right? He's not... what he's not focused on is the morale of the party. He's focused on the door. He's thinking about the words, right? He's thinking of candidates for words. He's trying to solve this problem. Clearly, he believed this was going to be a solvable problem, which is why he brought them this way in the first place. But I think that he is feeling under pressure too. And he's thinking about it. Again, what he's clearly not thinking about is jollying the party along at this moment. And I think when Boromir responds, and his response, though tactless, is very understandable. And I do think his words are being given to us in part because he is the spokesperson for the fear and bewilderment of almost everybody there. Right? I think they're all feeling afraid. I think that they're all feeling bewildered. I bet the hobbits are also thinking, wait, I thought Gandalf said he could lead us through this way. Why? How could that be if he didn't know how to enter, right? I mean, I bet you they're thinking that too, right? Yeah, Dr. Benway, I think that's exactly it. If I'm focused on something and I'm interrupted, I would certainly reply maybe a little sharper than expected. Exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly his response. And that's why we see the division in Gandalf's response to Boromir, right? His response to the first thing, right? To the first question, do not you know the word? Like, when he comes back and answers it more fully, he does give an answer, while if not exactly cheerleadery, is nevertheless designed to be, to some extent, reassuring, right? I don't know the word yet, but we shall soon see. But then he gives this rider, right? Then, on top of that, he's annoyed. He's annoyed at the things that Boromir has just said. When Boromir, his own defenses down, his own filters dropped, right, has given voice to the fear and bewilderment that he is feeling, which very clearly are challenging, do call Gandalf into question, suggesting that it was useless and therefore foolish in the extreme, jeopardizing all of their lives and risking ruin to their entire journey to lead them into this trap, because it's a trap, and not only it's a trap of the worst kind. Boromir thought it was a trap before. Like, you know, he said he thought the likeliest thing to happen was that they would end up trapped between wolves and the wall. And now he comes here and the trap is way worse than he thought it was going to be. Because not only are the wolves chasing them, now there's this horrible, dark lake of evil, right? Who's going to do who knows what, right? Anyway, so yes, are they challenges? Yes. And Gandalf shows that they have registered. And yeah, Jackie, he is, while Boromir's unfiltered words are sort of indirectly insulting. How could that be if you did not know how to enter? Right? It's a rhetorical question which puts Gandalf in an awkward position, right? Like, how do you answer that kind of question? Gandalf's insult, have you no wits left? Like, now there's a rhetorical question, which is a much more deliberate insult, right? Wolf says, my sympathy for Boromir in this reading has never been higher. I've been in a lot of meetings in which I feel just the same way. Absolutely. Absolutely. We have seen Gandalf be insulting many times. We've seen him be impatient. We have seen him perpetrate hobbitry with a particular edge to it, right? This is a little bit beyond that. Do you doubt my tale, or have you no wits left? So Gandalf is clearly, I do think that here we can see Gandalf under pressure as well. I think we see him distracted. I think we see him, again, that's why he failed to cheerleader before. We were talking about the kind of, that there's a sort of drama in Gandalf's response. The more I think this passage through, the more I'm questioning that. I think that he's not trying to create an effect by saying no the first time. I think that his subsequent words there are clearly kind of attempting to take back the dismaying effect that his words have. There's even a kind of annoyance, I think. There's only one person here who's responding properly from Gandalf's perspective. And that's Aragorn. What's Aragorn doing? Aragorn is doing two things. Right? He's doing two things of which I believe Gandalf fully approves. He is staying firm in his confidence in Gandalf's ability, even when things look uncertain. And he's shutting up and letting Gandalf get on with it, right? Yeah, he's bolstering Gandalf through his silence. That's exactly it. He's holding his tongue. He's not going to distract Gandalf. He's not going to question Gandalf. He's just, his confidence remains. And I think that that seems to me part of what Gandalf is annoyed by here. Is that to Gandalf, it's like, I don't know the word yet, but like the fact that I didn't walk up here already knowing what the word was doesn't mean we're in trouble, right? Doesn't mean that we're not going to get through this. We're going to be, just give me, let me figure it out. Right? Give me a minute here. Why are you being so quick to question me? Right? And I think that even his, again, not cheerleadery, but his fuller response, I do not know the word yet, but we shall soon see. It's almost like when Gandalf simply said no, he kind of thought that went without saying. The yet, but we shall soon see, right? Aragorn was hearing the implicit yet, but we shall soon see, right? If somebody had asked Aragorn, you know, is Gandalf going to come up with the word? He would say, we'll soon see, right? But Boromir's moment of panic here, right? And I think he's panicking, Boromir. His moment of panic, one of the premises of his panic is that he's not trusting Gandalf. He is losing his confidence in Gandalf. Now, I absolutely agree, Greyhame, that Aragorn is much more familiar with Gandalf's methods. And Leaf of Starlight, you're completely right that Aragorn is very wise, but he's also known Gandalf a long time. To Boromir, Gandalf is still a bit of an unknown. And I would add to that, what Boromir does know of Gandalf has not exactly inspired confidence. Right? I mean, we've seen this before. Boromir's frustration with the way this party is being led, he's got some legitimate complaints, right? Boromir's, if you think about it, what does Boromir have to go on here? As far as we know, all Boromir has to go on is that his father told him that Elrond of Rivendell was the greatest of lore masters. And Elrond clearly has confidence in Gandalf and has put Gandalf in charge of this expedition. Right? So, he has, if Boromir's confidence in Elrond is secondhand through his father, his confidence in Gandalf is third hand at best. Now, keep in mind, I'm not forgetting the fact that Gandalf and Boromir have met before. But that's why I said, so far as we know, because that has not come up. Yes, we're going to be told these things later on, but there is no evidence in the Fellowship of the Ring that Boromir and Gandalf have ever met before. So And yes, Leaf of Starlight, I think it's perfectly clear that the backstory of Gandalf in Minas Tirith and with Faramir wasn't a glimmer in Tolkien's eyes yet when he wrote this passage. That was yet to be discovered in future writing. I absolutely agree with that. However, even if we kind of work that backwards, if we kind of do that retcon in our heads, right? So without the retcon, based on all of the active information we have received in the book to this point, the only reason he has confident to, the only reason Boromir has to be confident in Gandalf is that Elrond, who had his father's, you know, kind of word of approval, approved him. And then he led them almost to disaster in the snow and bunches of other things, right? Even if, however, we project backwards what we later learn about Gandalf and Minas Tirith, about Gandalf's previous relationship with Boromir, we don't have any reason to believe that Boromir has any clear respect for Gandalf. Gandalf did say he'd been to Minas Tirith to read the records. Yeah, I mean, when he found Isildur's scroll, Matt. Yeah, no, he definitely had. But there's nothing in any words of Gandalf's or Boromir's in the council to imply that they met then or any other time, right? I mean, it's a big city, right? Like, presumably you could come and go to the library without meeting Boromir, especially if Boromir's out, you know, doing stuff. It's possible. Boromir has been very restrained, and I absolutely have been seeing that all the way along. But I don't believe that that restraint need necessarily be a reflection of his, of, you know, a modicum of respect for Gandalf. I think that I think everything that we've seen so far is equally explicable by the fact that he's being a good soldier, right? It would be clearly rude and inappropriate for him to just try to take over, for him to just push aside the appointed leadership of this company. This isn't his thing, right? This isn't his mission. This isn't his, you know, he's to put himself forward and take over the leadership, it wouldn't be appropriate. Dr. Benway, I totally agree that I doubt that Captain General Boromir is frequenting the library. Yeah, no, I don't think there is any reason to think, even keeping in mind the stuff that is said later on in The Return of the King, about Gandalf in Minas Tirith in earlier years, I mean. Even keeping that in mind, I don't think there's any reason to assume, certainly, that Boromir and Gandalf had any interactions with each other when Gandalf was there to read Isildur's scroll. Corey Schwab, exactly. There's all kinds of reasons why he would not put himself forward. As you say, he wouldn't be accepted as a leader. All the members of the company are familiar with Gandalf, and they wouldn't follow him. Yes. No, I agree. I agree. I think that he is both diplomatic and smart enough to realize, like, he's not in charge of this expedition, even if he might privately feel like perhaps he's the best qualified person in the room. And not without reason, he does have really good qualifications. And from his point of view, Things don't seem to be going particularly smoothly, right? Crossing the mountain passes in January didn't work out. Nobody could have seen that coming. They tried to go up the mountain without any firewood. Come on, people, right? Anyway, like, but again, he's not going to, it's, there are so many reasons why he's not going to just say, like, okay, so I'm taking over, right? But yes, well, but that's exactly the distinction I would make. I see him being politic. I don't necessarily see him being respectful. I mean, okay, like, I don't see him being disrespectful either. But you see what I mean? Like, I don't think, I'm not seeing an upwelling of respect from Gandalf. I haven't seen that at any point from Boromir. Yeah, Johnny, that's a really good point. Johnny is remembering when Boromir was about to laugh at Bilbo, when Bilbo volunteers, until he sees the reverence everybody has for Bilbo, right? That is one time, Johnny, you're right, in which Boromir is, like, out of step with everybody else in the room, right? And it's because he doesn't understand hobbits and he doesn't know Bilbo, right? To him, the manifest absurdity of the geriatric hobbit, you know, the geriatric halfling stepping up and being like, oh yeah, it's obvious you're begging me to come out of retirement. Okay, fine. Right. That just seems comical to Boromir and, you know, kind of understandably. And he doesn't have any of the context in order to properly get that. Right. But Wob, you're right. He instantly reads the room on that. Yeah, he's good enough and quick enough to not make the blunder. He could have done, right? He could have laughed out loud and said something regrettable, right? But he picks up on it really quick. His instincts were wrong. Understandable, but incorrect, right? But he does it. He does it right in the end. So Nerdosapiens, don't forget. Nerdosapiens was saying, I don't know why Boromir was included in the Fellowship. He's not passing the vibe check. Was he the best man they could find? Well, second best, you could say. Remember why? Because he's going their direction. Yeah, that's why. That's how Elrond rolls, right? It seems pretty clear that four members of the party are chosen simply because they were going to be traveling in vaguely the same direction. And so there's, Legolas, Gimli, Aragorn, and Boromir. I mean, nobody complains about Aragorn being a member of the party, right? Frodo, in particular, is delighted. But he's not in it for the ring. He's not on the, I mean, he's in the company of the ring, but he's not on the quest for the ring. He's got his own job, right? Aragorn is head of the Minas Tirith. Escorting the company of the ring gig, this is a part-time job for Aragorn. This is just a temp job. He's going to Minas Tirith. It's just, he's going to be going the same way as they will for a long time. So he's going to go with them. That seems to be, again, almost 50%. Well, if you don't count Frodo, fully 50% of the company was chosen by Elrond on exactly that premise. Well, they're headed in that direction anyway. And that seems to be, you know, he doesn't say something like, Elrond, that is, doesn't say something like, I think of Aragorn's words, you know, when he says things like, we shall take this as a sign, right? Aragorn talks like that. That's not Elrond's language. He doesn't talk that way. But it seems that he thinks that way, right? When he's deciding who should go with you, he's like, well, Aragorn and Boromir, no brainer. They're going in the same direction. And so that means, yeah, obviously, they should go along too. And Jackie, yeah, I do suspect there's good reason to think that Aragorn learned to think that way from Elrond, right? Yeah, I don't think he's not taken after strangers there. Nathan, it's a really wonderful question. Of course, a question that even Frodo doesn't know the answer to. What was Gandalf's plan? Was Gandalf planning to go to the Cracks of Doom with Frodo? I don't think it's a given. I don't think it's a given that that was what Gandalf's plan was. Anyway. Yeah. It's a small sidetrack, but it's relevant to Boromir and his attitude and everything else. I do think, therefore, coming back to, like, reading Gandalf's response and trying to understand Gandalf's frame of mind, I think that part of the reason Gandalf is so short-tempered and insulting here, so aggressive, so defensive, is that he is under a lot of pressure and he really is hoping for a little patience and trust here, right? Okay, I am under severe time pressure to come up with the answer to this riddle, and you guys jerking my chain doesn't make this any easier. You know what would make this easier? Not only just for you to pipe down, but for you to pipe down and have a little trust, okay? Can you just give me the benefit of the doubt here that I'm going to figure this out and let me work, right? Yeah, because of course we are going to say, John, I'm going to go on to it because it's worth looking at, right? He goes on because I don't want to stop Gandalf's speech in the middle here, right? We're not going to finish this slide tonight, but he goes on. If you wish to know, I will tell you that these doors open outwards. From the inside, you may thrust them open with your hands. From the outside, nothing will move them save the spell of command. They cannot be forced inwards. What are you going to do then? Asked Pippin, undaunted by the wizard's bristling brows. Knock on the doors with your head, Peregrine Took, said Gandalf. But if that does not shatter them, and I am allowed a little peace from foolish questions, I will seek for the opening words. I once knew every spell in all the tongues of elves or men or orcs that was ever used for such a purpose. I can still remember 80 of them without searching in my mind. But only a few trials, I think, will be needed. And I shall not have to call on Gimli for words of the secret dwarf tongue that they teach to none. The opening words were elvish, like the writing on the arch. That seems certain. Okay. So yes, the bristling brows. That's definitely a sign of anger, right? As we can see. Now, what Pippin is doing here. Pippin is not challenging Gandalf, right? Pippin isn't being rude, exactly. He's not suggesting Gandalf can't handle it. He's not expressing a lack of faith in Gandalf. His, what are you going to do then? Is just being Pippin? Yes, it is. It is. It's a reasonable question, but it's also an annoying question, right? Jackie, you're right about that. I love that. Gandalf's comment, Jackie was just pointing out, how Gandalf says, if I am allowed a little peace from foolish questions, plural, right? Pippin only asked one question. So Pippin's question obviously is a foolish question. From which Gandalf would like a little peace, right? But it does implicitly include Boromir's questions as well, right? He is lumping Boromir's questions into the category of foolish questions. And it's also possible, Johnny, yes, that he's anticipating more questions from Pippin. Yes, exactly. That question and all of the questions you haven't yet asked are foolish questions. And I would like peace from any further instances. Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. Now, Leaf of Starlight, I agree with you. None of them are on their own basis actually completely foolish. They're all very understandable, right? I mean, nobody knew that Gandalf came from the east, that the doors could be open, that they open outwards from the inside. You may thrust them open with your hands. Now, this is information that they had. Now, Gandalf's, again, so why... is Gandalf, what is Gandalf's justification for saying, have you no wits left? Why is he insulting Boromir's intelligence? Because it seems a perfectly sensible question. You led us here confidently saying you could lead us through, and now we discover that you don't know how to get in. How can this be? Right? That doesn't really seem foolish. At the very least, all of the questions, Boromir's question, and Pippin's question, are both understandable, right? They help us to see their point of view. Why does Pippin ask this question? He's worried. He's nervous. He wants reassurance. Tell me what you're going to do, right? Tell me what you're going to do. Gandalf is exasperated, and he's exasperated because, again, remember, what is the answer? What is the appropriate answer, right? What is the proper behavior right now? Shut up and let me think, right? Have a little faith in me and keep quiet so that let me work, right? I'm working on it. Trust me to work on it and give me room to work on it, right? Look at Aragorn. He's sitting over there confidently and silently. Can everybody go imitate Aragorn, please? And so what Pippin is doing is the opposite of that. What are you going to do then? I mean, this is a classic, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, most people who are parents have been in this kind of a situation, right? Where your kid is asking you to do something. And the question that they're asking you about doing the thing is preventing you from doing the thing, right? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. Yes. Like getting your attention to ask you why you haven't finished doing a thing yet that they've interrupted you from doing. Yes, exactly. Like it's exactly the kind of situation that Pippin, has created, right? In asking this question. It's very understandable. Because again, it is from Pippin, an expression of anxiety, but I would say Pippin's question does not seem to me to be so obviously, I think that Boromir is closer to the edge than Pippin is. There's less evidence. I know we don't get as much from Pippin here. Right. But there's less evidence to me that Pippin is like so gripped by fear that he's lost all of his filters. Right. So, I mean, it's still a very characteristic and hobbit-like, especially young hobbit-like. And it's true. Pippin's not even of age yet. Right. I agree, Valori. There's a certain amount of like tookish curiosity behind it. What are you going to do then? Right? So, how do we go about solving this problem? Right? Yeah, there's, I don't think he is gripped by fear to the same extent that Boromir is. Gandalf's threat of physical violence against Pippin, right? And further insult, right? Having insulted Boromir's intelligence, he then insults Pippin's intelligence, right? By implying that his head is so hard that it is the only thing present likely to shatter the gates of Moria. Gandalf's escalation to this point. And of course, like, I would say the very fact that he's threatening violence against Pippin like this, I do shows Gandalf's not just completely lost it, right? That's hobbitry, right? If he weren't insulting Pippin, I think it would be clearer that Gandalf had lost it completely, right? I mean, it's an annoyed response. It's possibly a short response, but it's still a joking response. I mean, that's funny. Knock on the doors with your head, but if that does not shatter them, and I am allowed a little peace from foolish questions, I will seek for the opening words. How does that sound? Yeah. That's interesting. JJ says, I feel like in some ways Pippin is the one Gandalf gets along with best. Gandalf is happiest when he can be irritated with someone. Yeah, exactly, Nathan. That is how hobbit friends talk. Gandalf's a pro at this kind of hobbitry. And even in this moment, he still is like, again, is he annoyed? Is there real irritation in his voice? I'm sure there is. I'm sure he's genuinely irritated with Pippin at this moment. But in some ways, I do think that it's, it is a, it's almost like a road back. I mean, the glint in his eyes when he says to Boromir, you may ask what is the use of my deeds when they are proved useless. Those are almost fighting words. And then he goes on to insult him. Have you no wits left? If Boromir had responded to that, this could have escalated, right? Like, there's serious issues here, potentially brewing, right? With Pippin, this isn't just an escalation up to another level of anger and annoyance, right? If anything, it's de-escalation here, because it shifts Gandalf from a real defensiveness, a real bristling against a potential challenge, to getting to throw a creative and comical insult at Pippin. There is some tension-breaking hobbitry here. Exactly. And notice how he brings it right back to, I will seek for the opening words, right? And also notice another thing. Remember the point of hobbitry. The point of hobbitry is to speak indirectly, right? It's not that you just say the opposite of what you mean. It's that you say indirectly what you mean, right? You don't just say it straight out, right? Remember that sort of emotionally tense moment of like emotional honesty between Bilbo and Frodo when Frodo was saying goodbye right before the I sit beside the fire and think poem, right? Which Bilbo had to like de-escalate by slapping Frodo and saying, ow, you're too hard now to slap, right? I mean, like, it's... when they speak directly about their feelings, they're uncomfortable, right? They tend to speak indirectly. And so notice, Gandalf is doing the same thing. And Notus Sapiens is very British. It's an extremely British kind of tendency here, this indirect speaking. Gandalf is... the hobbitry enables Gandalf indirectly to say what he really wants to say. What does he really want to say? Everybody shut up and let me think. I need some time to think of the answer to this riddle, to think of what the opening word of these gates should be. So how about we all have a little hush time while I'm thinking about it? Okay, like, that's what Gandalf wants to say. And so notice, Pippin gives him the opportunity to say it. His hobbitry gives him a chance to, he's, you know, if I'm allowed a little peace from foolish questions, I will seek for the opening words. That is what he wanted to say. Exactly, Dr. Benway. He wanted to say time. Give me time. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Oh, yes. And Jackie, you're reminding me to say, I saw somebody say, you know, ask if Tolkien talked to his friends like this. I believe, yes. I believe, yes, that that is the case. There is every evidence that there's every evidence that Lewis and Tolkien, for instance, and like, the, you know, the Inklings were pretty... spoke to each other like this. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, definitely a lot of banter. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Let's stop there. We will come back to the last paragraph on this slide for next time, when he talks about knowing every spell in all the tongues of elves, men, or orcs. Some stuff to think about there, what that implies. We'll come back to that, and then of course we'll kind of lump that together with the stuff that'll be on the next slide about him actually trying out some words and stuff. Anyway, thanks everybody, thanks for a fun discussion tonight. It's field trip time. Tonight we're going to see the outside of the doors of Durin, in game, see how they did those in game, how they depicted those post trashing of the doors from the outside by the Watcher in the Water. Okay.
Evening.
Hey there. All right. Okay, let me do my thing I was going to do here. Mm-hmm. Expand my screen. So, yeah, sure. So last week we'll remember that I was having an issue because I totally did not get the time to run Narnian through the quest to get us where we needed to go. But I discovered before I logged out last time that was actually a benefit.
Okay. Say more words.
Yeah. Because when we got inside the gates and went through, you know, the archway and went through and went up we saw the door standing open, right? Mm-hmm. Which is where you are at the end of that quest line. But since there's a kind of loophole, since Narnian has not completed the quest, if he steps back outside the door, he's still back in the phase of the game that shows the doors uncleared. So let me show you.
No, I believe you.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. All right. Anyway, so here I'm coming back in.
Yep.
All right. Here we are.
Hang on. Gotta raid you up here.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll join the raid. There we go. All right. Now we can go to Durin's Threshold. That's where we're going to start. Start our explorations of Moria.
Yep. That is a mile marker, I believe.
It is. A milestone. Yep.
Yep. Milestone.
Yep. All right. So here we are at Durin's Threshold. But now, what? Hang on a second. Gotta get out of that. Okay.
Yep.
But watch what happens when I go back. So now everybody else doesn't have to come back. She'll probably not be in the same place.
Yeah, but only you'll only be able to see it if you haven't done the Moria quest. If you haven't done the legendary quest.
Exactly.
Weapons.
All right. So
I'm going to hang out here.
So check this out. All right. We were looking at this last time. But we were looking at, like, the cleared spot and the open doors. So these are the... What I think is most interesting about this is the proportions. Again, this is a classic Lotro thing, right? They always make everything bigger in the game. And so look how big the trees are compared to the arch. Mm-hmm. Right? And the arch is, like... that. Even that is a little bit too big, right? If you imagine yourself standing at ground level here... unless Gandalf is like 3 feet taller than Narnian is, there's no way that the top of his hands could reach all the way up to that arch, right? So even based if I stand, I can't stand all the way. Yes, I can. Okay. Even if I stand all the way up here with my feet practically at the same level as Durin's hammer and anvil there, my outstretched arms could barely reach the top of the arch, right? So even the archway itself, as they've depicted it here, is like twice as large as it's described being in the book. And again, but look how tiny it looks. I mean, look how small that arch is compared to the trees.
See, okay, so I see where I went wrong, because remember I said I thought the trees were ripped up properly. You see those two branches next to the door? I thought those were the trees.
Aha, right, right. Yep.
Like, I couldn't see the trees for the trees.
Yeah. 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 So again, this is a really interesting visual adaptation issue. And it's a fascinating question of how you make decisions of how you depict things visually in a visual medium when you're trying to adapt the book. Because you basically can't be faithful to both things. Remember when we were coming across when we were way over there on the other side of the lake, and we came up the stairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking over here and you can see the two trees and they don't look huge, right? If there were two holly trees, maybe, you know, I don't know what, 20 feet tall, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, these trees are like 100 feet tall or more.
Absolutely. Right? Which also, I don't think holly trees grow that big.
No. Well, and they're supposed to be extraordinarily large for holly trees. But still, even if they're, you know, like 20 feet high and the archway of the gate is like 6 feet high, the whole thing would be barely visible from the other side, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are they prioritizing? They're prioritizing, first of all, wanting to give you the whole experience of seeing it from a distance. Again, it's just like the Stone of Erech, right? They give you the experience of being able to see it on the hilltop, looking creepy and alien and weird, right? And kind of unnerving, which you would certainly not be able to do if they made it proportional. If they followed the literal instructions of how large the things are. But more importantly, it wouldn't have the effect, right? Again, if the glowing arch were just like 7 feet high or something, you know, seven and a half feet high off the ground, and it were entirely covered by the debris here, which it would be, as when I stand next to it, this is clearly, you know, right about that much debris, right? There'd only be the tiniest bit of it showing up above.
Yeah. And part of it is to clear away the debris so you get that reveal.
Yeah, exactly. Because we can see the dwarf workers working here. And of course, as we mentioned last week, one of the quests is that you come in and you help to clear this out so that you can see the door. But yes, Emmathorn, you're right. They make the Ithildien very glowy in Lotro. It glows so strongly you can't even see the lines very clearly. You certainly can't read the text, which I think is interesting. But again, they do that so that you can see it from a distance, right? So that it shows up the way it should. Yeah. If it were just very fine lines barely reflecting the moonlight, as are described in the book, and as it would need to be in order for you to be able to read it clearly, you would barely even notice that it was there, and they want you to see it. And of course, there's also a kind of almost a sort of cheat that they can do in the game. And the cheat is that we already know what they look like. Like, it doesn't matter if you can't read the Tengwar on here, because you can see the Tengwar in the book, right? Like, we can see enough to see that they're representing the picture quite closely, right?
Yeah.
You know, we've even got the, you know, the N and the C runes up in the top corners, right? So clearly they're making an effort to do that very, very closely. And so therefore, if you're looking at it and you're like, wait, it's too bright, I can't see what it says, you don't have to puzzle it out. Just look in the book. You can see what it says, right? So instead of making it clear to read, they've made it plain to be seen and to make sure that nobody can miss it and that you see the thing that you're supposed to notice.
The one thing I like about Lotro is, like you said, just size-wise, it's one of those things where everything is as big as it feels.
Yes. Yes, that's the choice that they've clearly made again and again, right?
It's a visual metaphor.
Exactly. It is like a visual metaphor. It's like, so don't really measure it. Like, don't stand here and think exactly how, you know, wow, this is like the ceilings of this room are like 25 feet high, right? That seems a little unlikely or whatever, you know? I mean, goodness, think how high the ceilings are in Tom Bombadil's cabin, right? I mean, like, why would Tom Bombadil build his cabin with 14-foot ceilings? That seems unlikely, right? But again, if you're asking that question, you're thinking about it wrong. As you say, it's a kind of visual metaphor, right? If it were depicted realistically, that is, if the ceiling were actually, like, you know, 6.5 feet above the floor or whatever, as would often be the case in a cabin of that size, you know, in a little cottage of that size.
I got one of those myself. I scrape my knuckles every time I work out.
Right, exactly. Then it would, like, in the game, it would feel all cramped and you'd barely be able to see anything. And it would certainly not give you that sense of, like, comfort and domesticity that they're trying to create in Tom Bombadil's cabin.
Yeah, it's so, like, how they have to take away the fourth wall for a television, or they have to rebuild train cars so there's more room for cameras to go through. It's like there are practical reasons why things are different in a dramatized visual effort than would be in real life.
Yeah, exactly. And and that's it, exactly as you say, it's not about a literal visual representation. The visual representation is first and foremost about the kind of effect that it has on the viewer, right? The kind of effect that it creates. That's the reality, right? And so when they, you know, it's so a good adaptation will make that kind of choice. You know, we'll say, okay, if we have to choose whether to be true to, even when the dimensions are given, right, like, we're told exactly how large the Stone of Erech is, right? But if you can either depict it exactly as we're told it was, or you can try to capture the effect that reading about it has, you know, which is being truer to the book, right? And so very frequently they make that choice. All right, I'll come back inside now.
Yeah. Well, you also talk about things taking on a life of their own and being bigger than they actually are. It's like the exchange between Gandalf and Pippin. It's like that spawned a folklore in itself.
Right. Right.
As you've seen from the social media, even the Discord while we were having the class, like it was just Gandalf Pippin memes. It's taken on a life of its own and become its own tall tale.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, good. Now, one of the questions, Rowan was just saying the ceilings are ridiculous in here. yeah, exactly. Moria throughout, you know, this underground complex, the ceilings are like 100 feet high. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that does seem like if you are, as Sam implies, carving it out of hard rock, carving a tunnel 100 feet high for, you know, creatures that are only about 4 foot high at most, right? That's a lot of unnecessary labor, right? But again, like, what is the... So here we are, standing on Durin's threshold, right? We've just entered Moria here for the first time, going up the stairs backwards here. Okay. You're standing
here. You might say
here.
You feel rather dwarfed.
Yes.
By the proportions.
Exactly. You. It should not just... Like, the point is, the goal for it is for not for it to be realistically sized. It's about the effect that it has. It should make you feel small. If you look around, if you enter into Khazad-dûm, and your first impression is, this is a dank and narrow tunnel, then it's not had the effect that it should have. Right.
Well, we already had the dank fetid puddle outside. This is such a big transformation inside.
Yes, but, and that is also true. The contrast to the outside as well.
I mean,
yeah.
Do you remember like your first thoughts when you first saw this thing? Because I remember just like it goes all the way back and it's just the foyer.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. This isn't even like a real room.
Yeah. Well, it's the back door, so what, like a mud room, I guess?
Exactly, yeah. This is the mud room. Durin's mud room. yeah. Even the I love the extra kind of dimension.
It's extra.
Yeah. I like the extra dimension of that impression that the use being given to it by the Iron Garrison does. So the modern dwarves that are here, and of course we're not really doing the story here, we're just looking at the surroundings, but the dwarves that are here, and it's hard because I know in some places I'm all resistant to knowing the story, and so I'm not going to talk about the whole story a lot. I do know the story in Moria, so I kind of know what's going on, but the point is we see these modern dwarves here. And I think some of these conclusions I could have drawn myself even if I hadn't already played these quests. We clearly have these modern dwarves who have come in, and they're using this as a staging area, right? I mean, they've got all these crates and stuff here.
Yeah,
right?
This is base camp, yeah.
Yeah, this is their base camp. So the fact that they're using this, like, look at the massive piles of supplies and things that they're storing here. Right.
Yeah. Again, giving you an idea of how much there is inside.
Right. And yet, this room is still almost entirely empty.
Yeah.
And it's not even a room. Again, this is just a mud room. Like, this is just a hallway. Right.
Yeah.
And yet, this back door hallway of Khazad-dûm is so massive. So, I mean, it's bigger than a cathedral. Just
consider
itself.
Like all the palaces we've looked at before.
Yes. Such that like the entire supplies of this whole large dwarvish expedition is just like a few little, you know, stacks in odd corners of this.
We've seen Arnorian leisure palaces that would fit inside this.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. All those places in Eregion just outside. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So that the way in which this and the it's not just, so the ceiling is, looks like it's rude cut. So one answer to this is it looks like this was at least partially a natural cavern at the beginning, mm-hmm. because the ceiling is still raw. But they didn't have to do the walls like that, right? You know, the way that they finished the walls, the way they've, you know, with the huge statuary of the dwarves, both the dwarves that are kind of set into the walls there and the ones that are standing on the pillars holding the crystal lights, right?
Oh, I love the lights.
Yeah, those are really cool. Anyway, it's just, it is, this is a, I love both the grandeur of the threshold here, but also, in a sense, the kind of understatement of it. This is still just a hallway, you know. This is a...
So opulent, though.
This is a landing. The landing of the stairwell that leads in. And even though this was the back door, they knew it. Because remember, it's the back door, but this is where the elves come in, right?
Yeah, this is the part where you really want to shake up the elves and have them just sort of look around and go, oh, I didn't think it was like this.
Exactly. Yeah, you did... There's a certain amount of impress your neighbors going on here. With this.
Yeah, not quite a mudroom. Threshold. Not quite a mudroom.
Exactly. Exactly.
A beautiful back porch suitable for entertaining and barbecuing.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not going to, there will be parts of Moria. In fact, very soon, next week we'll go up the stairs perhaps. See what lies beyond. And it's, if I recall correctly, it's kind of interesting what we'll see just beyond the stairs here. But anyway, there's this clear effect. You look at how all the sight lines lead up the stairs, and it's not, the point of it is not to draw you to any particular point. Like, it's not like there's a giant statue of Durin in the middle in a spotlight or something like that, right? It's just, it sweeps you in and leads you up, right? You are ascending into Moria. You are, again, struck by the grandeur, drawn in to, the home and the, you know, just the mighty caverns of the dwarves. With mm-hmm. the dwarves looking down at you, both on the wall and up on the pillars.
Art deco angles jutting out everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really, really cool. Even the glowy crystals here from the start. I, by the way, I've always found that a really interesting thing about Moria.
What, glowy crystals?
The glowy crystals, yeah.
Conveniently placed so heroes can see where they're going?
Yes, exactly. Gimli speaks of the mighty lamps of Khazad Dûm. And I don't know. I feel like there is... Well, I want to think about this more. But of course, like, this is a Tolkien adaptation, right?
Like,
glowy gems and things, that's kind of important, right? That's a thing that comes up there quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, just a bit, yeah.
So, you know, how the dwarves kind of position this, how this would have impacted the elves when they come in. I don't think that these are made by the dwarves. It's not like these are each one of them sort of Fëanorian lamp or Silmaril technology. If I remember correctly, we will see evidence that these crystals grow naturally here.
Yeah, they're like naturally phosphorescent or something.
Yeah, there's something about these crystals that just glows.
My inner 80s child is just loving it.
Yes. Yes. But again, I can't.
And Lisa Frank.
I just, even through, like, with the Arkenstone as a kind of intermediary between the Silmarillion mm-hmm. stuff and this stuff, you just can't, I just can't detach myself from, you know, the, you know, all of the elf legends of light trapped in crystals.
Maybe this is like a diminished version of that technology.
Right. Or if they are natural, I don't think that that absolutely diminishes it. It's almost like, yeah, so your fan or chap had to invent these glowing crystals. Well, you know, we live in the place where that's just, you know, they're, you know, it's like how the Noldor used to scatter the gems on the beach, right? They'd make gems and there'd be like, you know, gems and jewels all just glittering in the sand on the beach, as like an expression of how, you know, rich and beautiful Valinor was.
Yeah.
It's almost like the same thing, saying the same thing about Khazad-dûm, right? Yeah, it's the place where, you know, sure, yeah, Feanor invented some shiny rocks and stuff, but here, shiny rocks grow everywhere. Like, it's just, it's not even a thing here in
Mars. A shiny rock? Call it Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, Rowan, you were asking about the damage on the wall. I think these, like, piles of debris here that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is all clearly more modern. Because we are looking at something that's been abandoned for an awfully long time.
Yes.
It's like 1,000 years since this was abandoned. So there have clearly been some, probably falls from the ceiling. Sometimes we can see places where parts of the wall have kind of collapsed.
Yeah, you see how it's eating that statue across from us due south?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's definitely from mineral deposits from the ceiling or building up from the bottom.
Looks like it. Yeah, so yes, there has been some there have been some collapses, there have been some issues, and of course we don't even know, some of this stuff could even be like actual damage. Like there was a, you know, there's been a Balrog kicking around in here for a while. So who knows how he might have wrecked the place, especially during the, because remember also when the Balrog comes out, this is something that's so easy to forget. When the Balrog emerges, like when the Balrog is first discovered, the dwarves don't abandon Khazad-dûm for, what, 3 years after? Like,
wow.
They cohabitate with the Balrog for like 3 years.
It's just like, we just don't go in this room?
I mean, it's big. It's a big place, right? So yeah, like their first impulse, like the Balrog wakes up and they don't say like, well, you know, there goes the neighborhood.
I'm just picturing Janine from Ghostbusters 2 going, well, just don't go in there. Right.
No, it's
worst roommate ever, Alvarez.
Worst roommate ever, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Don't you hate it when your downstairs neighbors are just like so intolerable that? I mean, goodness. But anyway, yeah, exactly. As Cal Elros says, Moria is big, the Balrog is sleepy, and the dwarves won't abandon a sacred place so readily. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. You know,
it's inconvenient. People still live within blast radius of Mount St. Helens and Pompeii.
Yeah, yeah. So the dwarves are only gradually driven out. And so, again, it's not like what we are seeing, what we should expect to see in Khazad-dûm is not like a place that everybody just one day suddenly abandoned, right? That is not, in fact, how it, that is not, in fact, how it went down. So that we might see in various places in Moria, damage from the time of, you know, battles against the Balrog seems to me perfectly expected. All right. Well, let us, again, next time, we will head up the stairs. We'll come back here, and then we'll head up the stairs and look where we're going. On the map, we can see we are in the part that is called the Great Delving. Hmm. So we've got some, we've got a bunch of ground to cover here.
Yeah, this is just one part of the map.
Right. Looking at the bigger map here, this, I think, is the whole of Moria.
Good gravy.
And so, yes, we're in one room in one section of the whole thing. There we go.
Just a reminder, if you didn't this week, make sure you bring a goat next week.
That's right. Yes, we
no
will need
goats.
No horses
in here.
We will need goats. That's true. All right. Very good. thank you very much. We'll see you guys next week. I should be around next week. So I will look forward to seeing everybody next week. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye now.